I'm Afshin Ratansi, and we're going underground as Washington and the EU continues to recognize President Macron as leader of France, despite today's 19th week of violent protests across the country, leaving thousands dead or injured. Coming up on the show, Canadian psychologist Professor Jordan Peterson, elevated by neoliberal war-supporting media like the New York Times and Guardian, comes to going underground. And the first Muslim woman to sit in Parliament, British peer Baroness Udin, on a British media political class, complicit in deadly Islamophobia. All this and more coming up in today's Going Underground. But first, the rise of identity politics has long been accused of masking the horrors of neoliberal austerity, of disguising class conflict as the driving force of the march of history. But our next guest sees not only identity as the enemy to fulfilling lives, but Marxism and socialism. Joining me now from Toronto in Canada is clinical psychologist and the international best-selling author of 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, Professor Jordan Peterson. Jordan, welcome to Going Underground. Let's just begin with what you think it says about free speech in Britain that Cambridge University made an announcement this week saying they weren't going to invite you to speak.
I think it says more about the nature of the universities in general than about free speech in general. I mean, I don't feel that my disinvitation has compromised my free speech ability because I have so many platforms on which I can discuss my ideas, but I think that it was handled in an unbelievably unprofessional, shoddy, and cowardly way. I mean, I was never even notified formally that this invitation occurred. I found out about it through the grapevine, and I still have no real explanation for why it happened. I've been only able to surmise the reasons. I think that, like, I was in Cambridge in November, and I did a very popular talk there, and there was lots of student interest and interest at the Faculty of Divinity as well. And I was really looking forward to working with the experts there on biblical issues. And I thought it would have been a very good collaboration for everyone, given the popularity of the biblical lecture series I did a year ago. And I think it's sad. And I think it's sad and shoddy, but I also think it's deeply reflective of how pathological the universities have become.
To be clear, you didn't tell them you didn't want demonstrators outside the lecture halls when you were speaking. This is clearly a sign of deliberate form of no platforming and censorship.
Well, I presume so. As I said, I haven't had any official notification.
Let's just get to some of the work. I mean, how key would you say in your work has been your opposition to socialism and Marxism in, of course, the best-selling book as well? Given at the moment the word socialism, of course, has a bit of a renaissance here with Jeremy Corbyn and in the United States with Bernie Sanders.
You know, I'm particularly concerned with the more radical end of the left distribution, or the left part of the political distribution, as well as the identity politics people on the right. I live in Canada. It's a moderately socialist country. I think that there's the introduction of certain forms of legislation that have been formulated by the, say, moderate left that I think have been beneficial to people. The problem is that, as far as I'm concerned, it's very difficult. It seems to be very difficult for people on the left to draw a line between what's acceptable and what's unacceptable, because obviously the left can go too far. And I would say all the emphasis at the moment on diversity, inclusivity, and equity is a sign that the left has gone far too far. I don't think that the radical end of the Democratic Party in the U.S. is going to be very successful in 2020. And I think the Democrats themselves know that. In fact, I'm fully aware of the fact that they know that. That party is actually moderated to a much greater degree than people are currently aware.
You just said yes. Diversity and equality has gone too far. I mean, obviously, you're speaking to a country which committed genocide against Native Americans. Justin Trudeau, your leader, is arguably trying to change the politics of Venezuela as part of NATO nation attempts to overthrow governments around the world. You think that's moderate socialist?
Do I think that Justin Trudeau in particular? I don't have
the country of
Canada amount of regard for Justin Trudeau. Well, I was thinking of policies like universal pension and standard working hours, and I think the universal health care system in Canada has worked reasonably well. It has its problems, but I lived in the U.S. and the health care system there certainly has its problems. It's the radicalization of the left that concerns me and the polarization that's a consequence of that. And mostly it's the emphasis on equity or equality of outcome, because I think that any attempt to pursue equality of outcome is doomed to a totalitarian tilt, because it's technically impossible to equalize outcomes across all possible identity groups. And then there's the problem of identity politics in general, which I think is a real catastrophe, where each person is viewed in the light of their sexuality or their race or their ethnicity, instead of being treated first and foremost as an individual, which I think is the great contribution of the West to, let's call it, interpersonal discourse and relationship and social structure. Any deviation from that's a catastrophe.
If I get to individuals in a second, do you find it amusing or surprising that people that maybe you describe as the hard left often have sympathy for your views on identity as a pretty poor tool of understanding history and who believe, obviously, that class is one of the greatest tools to analyze society?
Well, that is a strange thing. I mean, it's a sign of actually part of the pathological transformation of the left, I would say. The more moderate socialist types were concerned fundamentally about economic inequality and about economic class divisions. And, you know, inequality, I would say, is a problem, and it's a very difficult problem to deal with. But to transform that into race and ethnicity-based identity politics is definitely a regressive move. And it's surprising to me to some degree that that's that new story, let's say, which seems to be a combination of postmodern thinking and Marxist thinking, has actually captured the left to the degree that it has. And you can see the consequences of that because of its internal contradictions, because of the fact that people have multiple group identities. The left keeps devouring its own. You know, I kind of figured out when I wrote the foreword for Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, the 50th anniversary version, and I figured out while I was writing that, you know, because people have multiple group identities, it's possible to identify every single person as an oppressor along some dimension of their group identities, their multiple group identities, and then to justify their persecution. And it's the fatal flaw of this sort of identity politics, and it's a catastrophe for the left, and, well, it's a catastrophe generally because it's polarizing everyone, but catastrophe for the reasonable left.
Why focus on the left eating itself, though? I mean, what you just said there, I don't know whether you would assume that Michel Foucault is a postmodernist. Foucault would have said just exactly what you did about the complexities of power and the importance of power. In fact, he said we must cease to describe the effects of power in negative terms. Do you not see that your contribution to knowledge is actually benefiting the resurgence of the Marxist left, or a left that reads Marx in its original rather than through the eyes of the 60s counter-left campuses in the United States and in France?
Well, I don't see how my work could be contributing to that. I mean, Foucault's big problem, like many of the postmodernists, was that he believed that human relations could best be described in terms of power. And I think that that's absolute nonsense. I think that human relationships are best described in terms of competence and cooperation. And I think almost all the biological evidence supports that, as well as this reliable political and economic evidence. I mean, people don't base their relationships on power unless they live in tyrannical structures. They base their relationships on mutual productive work towards shared ends. And so, you know, I think Foucault was a... I've read Foucault's major works, and he's an interesting writer, but I think as a thinker, he's... To call him second rate is a tremendous compliment. It's very... You have to be very, very skeptical of people who reduce the causes of all complex phenomena to a single factor, like sex, Freud did that to some degree, or economics like Marx, or power like Foucault. You can tell a very compelling story about how that's the case, but the world is far more complicated than that, and it's a travesty to reduce the complexity of our social arrangements to power. And I certainly don't see that my work has contributed to a re-valuation, say, of the original Marxist stance on class. I do have some sympathy for the inequality argument, but I don't think there's any evidence that socialist structures, let alone communist structures, reduce inequality. All the evidence that I'm aware of points to the opposite, that inequality is actually less, for example, in Europe than it is in the rest of the world, even though there's still high levels of inequality.
You know, presumably, that the United States imprisons more people per capita than Stalin or Mao, and that the country you're talking to me from, Canada, has supported wars that have killed, wounded, or displaced tens of millions of people just in the past 10 years or so. You don't believe power relations are useful because totalitarian systems are the ones are different to the ones you are currently living in North America?
No, I don't believe that analyzing human relationships purely through the lens of power is of sufficient explanatory complexity.
I don't think Foucault didn't say purely either.
I don't agree with that.
But Marx
he may
certainly
never
didn't.
Have said that directly, but well, Marx certainly concentrated on economic class divisions as the fundamental driving force of history and inequality. And so, and I mean, look, every political and economic system, every complex system that human beings have ever formulated has its pathological element. It's inevitable. There's always a dark side to things. The question is, how dark? And my sense is that the totalitarian systems that emerged in the 20th century, both on the left and on the right, were far darker than their democratic alternatives, despite the fact that their democratic alternatives also had their own problems. You know, and Winston Churchill was right when he said of democracy that it's the worst form of government except for all the others. And I'm a pessimist and a realist in matters such as that. I know that all of our social systems are destined to remain deeply flawed. The question is whether they spiral completely out of control, and they certainly did under Mao and Stalin and Hitler.
If you're a child, say, in Iraq, or a child in the Grenfell Tower, not far from this studio, which highlighted austerity, post-28 austerity in this country, where is the individualism? I'm not even a child, say a teenager or an adult. Where is the ability to choose without the economic means to have choice?
Well, the economic means constrain to some degree, but they certainly don't constrain absolutely. I mean, there's always the possibility for social mobility of
well, not when they're dead,
of
obviously.
One form or another. Well, definitely not. Look, I mean, I'm not foolish enough to presume that the adoption of individual responsibility and the striving that goes along with that is necessarily going to produce a positive outcome. My contention is that the best bet that you have in this veil of catastrophe and tears is to take responsibility for your own life and to speak truthfully and to act courageously. And the difference between that and the standard, let's say, individualist philosophy is that the individualist types tend to concentrate on rights. And I don't concentrate on rights. I concentrate on responsibility. And I believe that even under constrained economic conditions, and that your best bet, the best chance that you have in life to garner a certain amount of meaning and engagement is to speak the truth and to engage with the world courageously. And that's not an economic argument. It's independent of economics. It doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor under those conditions. It may matter with regards to your socioeconomic outcome. But look, part of the reason that people find my work meaningful is because I am directly talking about the fact that people find the meaning that sustains themselves in their lives through the sorrow of their lives.
Jordan, I'll stop you there. More from Professor Jordan Peterson after this break. Plus, institutional British Islamophobia with Britain's first Muslim woman peer, Baroness Udin. All this and more coming up in part two of Going Underground. Welcome back. I'm still here with Professor Jordan Peterson. Do you think that your work is particularly attractive to those whose pride is in a sense been injured or been hurt by widespread recognition that their positions come from privilege and not from competence?
No, I don't think that at all. I think that my work is attractive to people who have been hurt in all sorts of ways over the last decades by an overemphasis of discussion of impulsive happiness, extensive rights, materialist shallowness, nihilism, and ideological rigidity. I think that my work is attractive to people who haven't found any profound basis on which to ground their existence. And I think the
changing world, perhaps, where the kind of identity diversity has been an easy thing to blame for their own lack of economic woe, their own lack of economic power?
Yes, well, I mean, that's part of the pathology of the present, is that there is always an easy factor to blame. And it's not like there aren't factors to blame. Life is arbitrary in many ways, and people are subject to forces that are beyond their any easy control. That's the thrownness that the existentialists of the 1950s insisted upon. There's an ineluctable arbitrariness about life, and it's very easy to become resentful and vengeful as a consequence of contemplating that. But my proposition to people is that that's a dark road, and that it makes everything worse rather than better, which is not that's not an improvement. If the conditions you're complaining about led to the vengefulness initially, you have rectify
that. If you're
that.
Referring there to Sartre in the 50s, who of course was a fan of China, Che Guevara, I mean, 500 million people have been lifted out of poverty in China since 1981 to 2012. You don't see traces of what happened in the movement supported by those very same 50s existentialists. You don't see that lineage.
Well, it isn't Sartre that I was considering. I was considering that there's a group of existential phenomenologists that were more crucial to
the
development
after,
of psychology. But so I wasn't thinking about Sartre. And, you know, I'm not an admirer of Sartre, mostly because of his insistent dalliance with the communists, and far longer than anyone with any sense should have. I see the economic miracle that's occurred in China and India and, well, throughout Southeast Asia and increasingly in the rest of the world as a consequence of the spread of the same sort of ideas that made the West rich. It's just 50 years afterwards or 75 years afterwards, which isn't very long from a historical perspective, but the spread of ideas that are associated with private property and capitalist interactions, clearly what's lifted China out of poverty, although not yet out of totalitarianism.
Of course, I think members of the Chinese Communist Party, if I interviewed them, would say that's too reductive. Do you think, I mean, I noticed there's some controversy that you've tweeted to promote the Institute for Humane Studies, which is funded by the Koch brothers. Is there essentially very right-wing, and some would say extreme right-wing, use of your work? The Koch brothers, of course, lobbied for wars that killed, wounded, or displaced tens of millions. They obviously oppose any environmental policies and any policies of that kind.
Well, if you want to know what the right wing thinks of me, you could read Jordanetics by Vox Dye, and you'll find that I'm very unpopular among the right wing identitarian types.
Now, I know you quoted Winston Churchill and you like doing it. Obviously, for many people around the world, he's considered to be a mass murderer. Even in Ireland, he set up the Black and Tans in the Bengal famine and so forth. You are an honorary member, as regards colonialism, of the Kwaka Waka Wako tribe in British Columbia. Tell me about that tribe and why you're an honorary member of it, and how, whether you're in the fight for the return of art looted by colonialism in British Columbia.
Well, I would say I'm not part of the latter, but the reason that I'm associated with that tribe is because I started working with a native carver named Charles Joseph, who I regard as quite a genius, who was a survivor of one of Canada's most brutal residential schools and had a childhood that was so indescribably awful that, well, if you heard it would bring you to tears. I've worked with Charles for 15 years, buying his art, and which I think is quite remarkable, and learning about his culture. And we've had a very successful collaboration. And as a consequence, I was invited to join his family in a ceremony in on Vancouver Island. There was a ceremony with about 500 people, a potlatch, which is a traditional Kwakwaka'wakw ceremony. And our relationship has been, I would say, primarily personal. You know, I've helped him with some of the consequences of his catastrophic childhood experiences. We've managed to bridge the huge cultural gap between us and our societies to formalize a lasting friendship. And
can I ask finally then, I mean, I know Vancouver Island, and you presumably know the mass deforestation of that island off the coast of British Columbia. How important is the environment, which is touted as the greatest threat to humankind, even greater than lack of psychological self-analysis, let alone lack of class awareness?
Well, I don't think it is more crucial than lack of psychological insight, because I think that societies that put themselves together properly will look to the long run, in the future long run, and they'll take the steps that are proper with regards to attempts to make things sustainable, which is very difficult. I mean, you know, all the news on the environmental front isn't bad. There are more forests in the Northern Hemisphere, for example, than there were 100 years ago, and there's more forests in China and India than there were 30 years ago. Is that there's a very powerful streak of anti-humanity that runs through the more radical end of the environmentalist movement. It's reflected in ideas like that human beings are like a cancer on the planet's surface, which I find an unbelievably repugnant idea. And I think that we're not doing so badly at trying to clean up the mess that we generate while we're struggling to survive. And it's not like the mess isn't real and that there aren't dangers associated with it, but my proclivity is to have some sympathy for people as they do what they can to live under the harsh conditions that constitute the circumstances of our lives. And I think that we'll be wise enough to clean up our own nest. I think the evidence suggests that if you can get people in general above GDP of about $5,000 a year, they start to become quite concerned with their environmental conditions and to work diligently to try to make the circumstances in which they live sustainable in the long run. But in conditions of dire poverty and immediate day-to-day want, it's very difficult for people to attend to anything that might be remotely concerned with long-term environmental sustainability.
Professor Jordan Peterson, thank you. Well, someone who certainly supports the need for vigilance in the protection of the human rights of diverse groups is our next guest, the first Muslim female peer in the House of Lords, Baroness Uddin. She joins me now. Baroness Uddin, welcome to Going Underground. First of all, before we get to 25 Tories suspended for Islamophobia, your reaction to the week's atrocities in Birmingham. 5 attacks, 4 mosques hit, the West Midlands Police saying at the time, immediately after, the motive behind it yet to be established.
I'm not surprised, okay, that there is 5 places of worship that's been attacked, and it's been reported, which is a really good thing. We have, over 1,000 masjids, and often people don't report it. So I think in light of the fact that attacks have become so serious and so grievous, that I'm really pleased that communities are reporting it. And I'm just absolutely shocked that, you know, it is not yet being taken as seriously as I'd like to see.
Why do you think the media would not report what are either counter-terror or criminal actions?
I can't speak for anyone else except to say that most community organizations will tell you that the numbers of attacks and the level of threat against them, because they're simply Muslims, is huge, and it's hugely underreported.
Okay, but the UK Security Minister Ben Wallace, after the Christchurch massacre, said Britain's strong mainstream media is a rock in the storm. Can you at least celebrate our mainstream media in the face of Islamophobia?
I mean, I think what I want to say is that in the heart of our parliament, heart of our many, many notable institutions, lie, you know, quiet Islamophobes. And I think Tory party, the 25, you know, or 15, whoever has been suspended. It's just one small example. And I think that Ben Wallace ought to seriously re-examine what he says in light of what is blatantly fact. I mean, you've got some of the headlines right behind you, and I think that it speaks for itself about where the commitment in the mainstream media is about Muslims and Islam.
The British government is spending $25,000 per Jewish institution to curb the rise of anti-Semitism, which also has been on the rise. Only $5 million for all Islamic institutions in terms of special protections now, given the rise in Islamophobia. Should it be equal?
Oh, I think, you know, any sensible minister looking at their action would know instantly that there has to be equality, whatever the hatred is. And I think that that's really important. I mean, I just want to take this opportunity to say, and I think the Prime Minister of New Zealand has said, an enormous benchmark for other leaders to follow. And I think I'm just so proud as a woman to associate myself with the kind of stand and the positioning that she has taken. And it's so sad that, you know, in Houses of Parliament, you know, there was a debate on recently on Islamophobia, and there are still Islamophobic comments made against Islam and Muslims very blatantly, as though it's, you know, part of the nature of democracy, you know, so that people are able to, you know, sort of stand and say, I'm speaking because I'm entitled to make free speeches, without realizing what the consequences is. And the consequences is the attacks on Birmingham masjids. So I think that we have to be very, very seriously responsible. I also want to tell you that on the day that we had a debate on Islamophobia a few weeks ago, Tommy Robinson visited that same afternoon, and a number of us.
Far right.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's well known. He's been, you know, indicted for it. And yet he visits the Houses of Parliament, the heart of democracy, on the same day, to say as though, well, you know, you do not matter. Islamophobia doesn't matter. And the reason I think we're speaking up so often, we're having to speak up so often, is because our government is so far behind and so much in the dark ages in terms of addressing hatred. We have to take it seriously. When somebody speaks race hate, when somebody speaks, you know, hate against Islam, hate against Muslim women, for instance, are part of, you know, our lives. And so if Cameron can get away saying that somehow, and I'm paraphrasing it, I don't want to be, you know, sort of quoted directly in that sense, but I'm paraphrasing, when Cameron, as a prime minister, can get away saying if Muslim women spoke English, that somehow there'd be less terrorism. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. And not one newspaper, mainstream newspaper, stood up and said this is unacceptable.
Anna Sudan, thank you.
Pleasure.
That's it for the show. Keep in touch via social media. See you on Monday when we investigate the US-style ideological threat to healthcare around the world.